My name is Mylon Houston, and as the Chief of Library and Museum Archives at the Museum of Modern Art, I'm really pleased to welcome you to this evening celebrating the publication of MoMA's Library Council's latest artist book, The Three Gorges Dam Migration by Yunfei Ji. Now, there's a beautiful term used to describe a meeting of cultivated individuals who exchange ideas through poetry, calligraphy, music, and painting, and that term is called yachi, or elegant gathering. And I think tonight's panel exemplifies the long tradition of cultural fellowship that has been central to life in China for centuries. And I'm grateful to the speakers and to MoMA's education department for helping us celebrate this magnificent work of art. Before asking Jay Levinson, director of MoMA's international program, to introduce our first speakers, I want to cordially invite you all to join us for a reception at the conclusion of the panel, where Yunfei Ji's scroll will be on display, and that will be held in the library's sixth-floor reading room, which can be reached by the elevators on the far side of the lobby outside this theater. So thank you all again for being part of our elegant gathering. Jay?
Thanks very much, Mylon. I'll introduce our first two speakers so as not to interrupt the flow of talks when we start. First, Jonathan Spence. Professor Spence is the Sterling Professor of History Emeritus at Yale, where he's been teaching since 1965. He's a great authority on the role of history in shaping modern China. He's been president of the American Historical Association. He's a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and he's a recipient of many academic honors, including both MacArthur and Guggenheim Fellowships. He's the author of over 15 books, including the critically acclaimed The Search for Modern China, which has become one of the standard texts on the last several hundred years of Chinese history. It was my own introduction to modern Chinese history. Of course, we have to remember that Chinese history is much older than ours and that modern history begins in the 17th century for China. But in addition to big picture accounts like this one, Professor Spence has written a whole series of books on particularly fascinating personalities and periods of Chinese history. One is the amazing Jesuit priest who's the hero of his memory palace of Matteo Ricci. Another is God's Chinese Son, an extraordinary account of the 19th century Taiping Rebellion. There are a whole series of books like that, and Professor Spence's fans, of whom I am one, really treasure these accounts of small segments of Chinese history. He'll be speaking this evening on the history of the Yangtze River and on the history of the scroll form itself in China. Wu Hung will speak after Professor Spence. Professor Wu is the Harry A. Vanderstappen Distinguished Service Professor of Art History and East Asian Languages and Civilizations at the University of Chicago. He's also the director of the Center for the Art of East Asia and a consulting curator for the Smart Museum of Art at the University of Chicago. Last year, you may remember, he opened an extraordinary exhibition on the Three Gorges entitled Displacement. Professor Wu studied at the Central Academy of Fine Arts in Beijing. He's also served on the research staff of the Palace Museum, which is, of course, located inside Beijing's Forbidden City, and he's been at Chicago since 1994. He specializes in the full range of Chinese art from the earliest years into the present, and his special research interests include the relationships between visual forms and ritual, social memory, and political discourses. He's the author of numerous publications. He's also served as the curator of important exhibitions of contemporary Chinese art, such as the first Guangzhou Triennial in 2002, and also with Christopher Phillips, the photography show Between Past and Future, New Photography and Video in China from 2004. Also on a personal note, he's editing an important new publication for the Museum of Modern Art. It's on contemporary Chinese art, and it will be the first systematic introduction to documents of Chinese art over the last 30 years. It's part of an ongoing series published by my department to make important art historical writings from regions outside the United States available to an English-speaking audience. Professor Wu will be speaking tonight on the art history and politics of the Three Gorges. So we'll start with Professor Spence.
Well, thank you, Jay, and thanks, everybody, for coming. And I'm truly excited to be in, able to speak about Jiyu Anfei's painting, which I've just been looking at here and in the show upstairs in the Judith Rothschild collection, and also one of his antecedent painters, Luo Pin. I was just asking if he really was an antecedent painter, and he agrees he was. A wonderful Chinese 18th century painter on whom there is really a breathtaking show right now at the Met. So we have some of Ji's work upstairs in MoMA. We have one of his inspirers in the Met, and here we have Mr. Ji himself. So I'm delighted to be here speaking about your work. Very briefly, I've been told, very briefly. One point I'd make, I think, at the very beginning, as a historian, is that it is possible to look at Chinese history, and there are some scholars who do this, as really a tale of environmental battles. If you go very, very early into Chinese society and politics, you find problems of over the environment. You find enormous feats of engineering, highly technical engineering, long before there were civilized societies in many parts of the world. And one of the greatest cultural heroes in the early Chinese saga of its own history is a person who carved open the mountains and made way for the rivers. This was the definition of Yu the Great, who is a sort of a culture hero, not necessarily a historical figure, but stands in Chinese texts as somebody whose contribution to the country was tampering with and gouging out and rebending and reorganizing the spaces and the waters of China, so that rivers, the tumultuous rivers, their high siltation rates, the extraordinary dangers of navigating them, and these have all been parts of China's long historical traditional mode. And in case any of you get to Beijing, to the Forbidden City, in the right-hand corner of the Forbidden City palaces, you might see one of the world's largest ever known pieces of jade. It weighed over 5 tons when it was discovered in far western Xinjiang. And when this jade was shipped all the way from far west to Beijing, and they tried to decide what to do with it, the Qianlong Emperor, the most powerful emperor in 18th century China, decreed that this jade be kept whole and from it be made a sculpture, a jade sculpture of this enormous size of Yu taming the rivers. And so symbolically this was kept as a major theme. In the colophon to his own scroll, which you'll be seeing tonight in detail, Ji Yunfei has a brief sort of introduction. This colophon comes in the calligraphy at the end of his scroll. And he tells us there that since antiquity, he writes, rivers have flooded in China and humans have sought to control them. And although this represents more than 3 millennia of work and passionate commitment by the Chinese, it remains true that the waters have caused trouble and that the Yangtze River, the Long River, the Changjiang in particular, almost seemed to be untamable. And he tells us that it was the ongoing perils from the Yangtze River waters that really led in the very early 20th century to the first thinking about damming the huge Three Gorges region with a goal of cutting down floods in the far east of China and also of developing electricity and thermohydraulic power of various kinds. And then he gives us two historical names to hold on to in the same colophon. Mr. Ji tells us that Dr. Sun Yat-sen, using his honorific name, that Dr. Sun first broached the subject of possibly building one of the world's most immense dams just beyond the Three Gorges on the Yangtze, and that later this was followed up by Mao Zedong, by Chairman Mao, in discussions with the communist leadership. But it was only, of course, finally in the 1990s that major ground was broken and that huge project got underway. And I think what drew Mr. G to this, I can see, is the colossal scale and the historical resonance, I think, of what was laid open by this attempt to tame the waters. Some of that I think you'll be hearing about again from other panelists, and I'd like to come back to a different sort of theme as a historian who keeps confronting the river, as it were, when you look at the history of China. In a way, without having any complicated maps of China in your head, you will know that there's a great long sort of eastern China coastline, but then as you get further and further inland, you end up in the Tibetan highlands or the Central Asian regions, and the waters are flowing from west to east with extraordinary force. And in a way, the Yangtze River and then the Three Gorges is like a kind of arrow cutting into the body of China. It slices through China. It cuts across any of the north-south rivers and just drives its immense way, its passionate way, one could say, because of the huge volume of waters and the amount of people who depended on this area. I won't, I think you'll be relieved to know, recite a list of all the battles that were fought along the Yangtze, of all the struggles for power that took place in this region, except to say that it is not only an environmental problem, it was a strategic and economic part of China's history of enormous importance. And this became very, very topical in a way as time went on, because the vulnerability of China's Yangtze River in particular became more and more apparent as world history entered the 19th century period. Before then, China's emperors had often devoted enormous concentration of effort to working on these on the river. As I mentioned, environmental science was crucial, and they used also the help from Western missionaries, some of who had been well-trained in environmental sciences or in control of river flows. But it was really the steamship, the steamboat, the river-traveling steamboat that changed the nature of the old battle of the Yangtze, which was pulling for about 1,500 kilometers, pulling huge laden barges, the whole width of China, as it were, deep into its heartland, to get to the city of Chongqing. That was an upriver battle, as it were, and many of you may have seen paths literally worn in the rocks along each side of the gorges from the bare feet of the hundreds of millions of people who pulled barges and boats up that narrow defile for more than 3,000 years. And so there's a sort of mute testimony of the feet of the laborers grinding into the rock, really, the bare feet. And so the connection of huge human labor with the incredible riches of inland China, of Sichuan province itself, this linkage, the idea of struggle and wealth and vulnerability always come to my mind when I think of this period. Steamships, however, were able now, when attached to passenger barges of some kind or another, small passenger ships and or heavy laden cargo vessels, they could now chug their way relentlessly upstream against the current, and it shifted all kinds of patterns of economic life and possibility in China itself. And as I said, vulnerability became part of this, because along with the steamships going upriver, one began to get other kinds of ships, including steam, but also sailing vessels and barges coming downriver, and many of these were carrying opium. So in the strange saga of the spread of narcotics in China, pretty much all of the early narcotic spread came because of Western powers forcing opium on China, and then China began to develop its own opium fields in Sichuan and the far west. The route became not only crisscrossed by the steam vessel, but it became a sort of a gang warfare lamb between foreign powers and Chinese syndicates dealing with opium and its problems. Far inland, at the great sort of terminus of the gorges, in Chongqing city, that region also now got integrated into world history by being made a treaty port zone so that foreigners could come and go as they chose without permission from the Chinese government to trade there. And then it became a way for a new country to enter China's heartland with enormous consequences for the future because many of the steamship companies were taken over by the Japanese. And so you've got a Japanese technological mastery of the river confronting the Chinese struggles and the foreigners' determination to use this waterway for their own complex economic regions. And then in World War II, for those of us who were around then, in World War II, Chongqing, inland, up the gorges at the very height of the river, became again the site of some of the heaviest bombing during World War II. As again, Japanese Air Force, working with the invading forces, tried to pulverize Chongqing into rubble. And enormous damage was the result, though the city did survive and is now one of the world's largest and most vibrant economic sort of metropolises. But the gorges now are linked with all these historical sort of memories attached to them and to their lives. I think a couple of things I'd like to mention just in the last few moments here. One is this theme of displacement, which Jay Levinson talked about, and Wu Hung did this, I think, fascinating book of three or four, I think, Chinese painters who saw the possibilities as artists in what was presented by the idea of the gorges and the idea of the struggles that came from it, and then the development of that little passage in the colophon as the government itself began to step in and suggest that they should do something about controlling this river. So the idea that I can see forming in Mr. Ji's mind, as much as I can guess, is that this need to dam the river and the feeling that this was becoming essential because the floods were so bad, but there was also other major irrigation problems, communication problems. There were other very difficult aspects to this problem. But the one that caught his attention was the most human of all, which was the dislocation of millions of people who were already leading difficult lives or anguishly difficult lives and were losing now their homelands as well and all the livelihood that went with the multifarious trading and struggling and tensions that went along with this colossal riverine system. And as Ji Yunfei began to develop this theme, it became, I think, a passion in his art. And he's handled it in many, many ways. He's seen sort of the river as a mighty force, elemental, in some of his scrolls. He's seen it as a backstage presence in some of them. But always, and I think increasingly over the last few years, Ji has been putting more people into the picture and struggling to understand how the people who had so little to begin with are going to make it now that their very river is being taken from them. And in the screen, in the scroll itself, as it currently stands, and the one that we'll be looking at, I guess, after the talking this evening, it is only one of many, many versions in progress, in motion, as it were. But to me, the thing that is most important and moving about this scroll that we'll be seeing, in which Ji Yunfei tries to capture all this, is in a way the ordinariness of the people, the sense that these are our neighbors, and it's only a small jump to see it as being this is us. We are now seeing our fields and our ancestral grounds slowly disappearing under the water. There's going to be no going back unless there's some unbelievably catastrophic disaster that lowers the level again, which some engineers have warned may happen. But basically, it's the sense of the dislocation of the elderly, the young, the middle-aged, the children, occasionally even livestock or and occasionally a sort of an image of terror, like I see it as a wild hog with a sort of a blackened face and whiskers that you'll see if you look carefully. Just at one tiny point in this scroll, Jesus sort of injects what seems to me a figure of pure evil into the midst of the innocent people who are being uprooted. And in the scroll that we're seeing up after the discussion tonight, again, to me, one of the moving things about that is that the river and the torrent and the gorges and so on are very much muted. In fact, they're now kept much more outside the scroll. And the scroll itself is filled with all the things that we fill our own life with. It's just the Chinese version of bamboo chairs and wicker and those blue and red bundles that everybody carries, and the piles of cooking ware and the children struggling for attention and piles of old clothes and so on. This is what you end with, I think G is telling us, when you jam through a sort of revolutionary change and you throw people's lives into an extraordinary turmoil. And having spent a good deal of time in my life looking at sort of 17th and 18th century scrolls, I couldn't wait in a way to get to the end, because you go through these scrolls piece by piece and you can see what's coming. And then when one got near the end, in a traditional scroll from earlier Chinese history, you would nearly always have seen some kind of wreathing mist and a sense of the aura of the state and the power of the emperor. And one gets used to some of those the scrolls of the early southern tours, for instance, of Emperor Kangxi and then Qianlong's tours later on. You get used to this very formalized kind of motion towards a point, a mysterious point where the state lives. In other words, you know these are the palaces, and that's where your eye has been taking you. But in Jiyun face painting, when you get to the end of this disruption of these millions of lives, and you get an expanse of water, you kind of think you're coming home, as it were. And then as your eye travels, you see you're looking straight at five policemen in a sort of pontoon boat, as I see it, a little boat. You can't really see their faces, but you can do worse. You see their uniforms, and you see them closing off the scroll. And I think Mr. G is saying something here, very direct, very powerful, and very sad, about the power of the state when it goes along with the helplessness of the individual. Thank you.
Can I have the images? Sorry. You can see it's a very large topic. I have 15 minutes, so I try to rise to the challenge. Again, I want to start from this Three Gorges Dam, or the whole thing is called the Three Gorges Project in Chinese. We know that this dam is the largest hydraulic project ever attempted in human history. And we also know this project provoked very sharp controversy since it's the idea just started. And even when the whole project started, there are a lot of debates. There's basically two different camps in China and outside China. For example, its advocates expected the dam to generate clean energy. That's a major argument, crucial for China's economic growth and social stability. I'll just give you some numbers, pretty powerful, actually. For example, they say that this dam would supply one-ninth of the country's electric power. Just one dam provide one-ninth of power, equivalent to 50 million tons of coal a year, 25 million tons of crude oil, or 15 nuclear power plants. They also argue that the dam would lower greenhouse gas emissions, boost trade in China's deep interior, and help control the chronic flooding in the area, which killed 300,000 people in the 20th century. So that's all pretty positive kind of argument. But the critic of this project, on the other hand, emphasized the human cost and the environmental impact. There are maybe some pictures I want to show. So those flooded area, you can see the pink part. It's actually enormous area. That's a few scenes about the enormity of this project. And here it really implies the damage, the cost. So the critics emphasize human cost, environmental cost, and they say that by this project completion, more than 1.1 million people would have been forced to relocate. Near 1,400 villages and towns and cities would have been flooded. And debris of the submerged factories and hospitals would contaminate the river. This is a beautiful river. And the ecosystem, the whole region would be disrupted. Moreover, a large number of historical and archaeological sites will be permanently lost. And the natural beauty of the Three Gorges, so much admired in traditional painting and poetry, will be changed forever. So that's another side. Debate is still going on. Even now, the dam is near its completion. We are familiar with this argument in words. Numerous articles, news reports, books, and sociological and environmental studies constituted a large body of literature. But there are other kinds of responses to the Three Gorges Project that have less to do with policy issues, but reveal more sensitively about human response. More sensitivity to the actual changes brought about by the project. And these are artistic representations of the Three Gorges Project, which are abundant in quantity and wide-ranging in medium. Actually, I want to suggest they really constitute a very important part of contemporary Chinese art. So I want to give you a larger context so we can really understand Ji Yunfei, this very important work. And so I want to actually talk about several artists. I don't know if you know these two movies. If you haven't seen them, I really highly recommend. This called the English is Still Life by Jia Zhangke. It won the Gold Lion Award in Venice, and the Yan Mo is documentary. Both are fantastic movies. And I want to focus on these four artists, Ji Yunfei, Liu Xiaodong, Zhuang Hui, Chen Qiuling. Later, I will see the images. One reason for me to select these four artists is because of their very different, markedly different medium and style. Liu Xiaodong is arguably the second one. Liu Xiaodong is arguably the best-known realist painter in today's China. And Ji Yunfei employed the traditional medium of ink, color, and paper. Zhuang Hui, the third person, is a veteran conceptual artist. And Chen Qiuling is a newly emerging performance and video artist. Without coordination, they all traveled to the Yangtze River and created very powerful works to respond to the Three Gorges Project. Through their works, we can also see some major trends in contemporary Chinese art. So we should realize, actually, they don't have sponsors. They just travel there on their own. They raise the fund. They sometimes work for a prolonged period. So that means something. I start from the youngest one, Chen Qiuling. She grew up in Wuxian, that is her hometown, on the upper reaches of the Three Gorges. So she is a native. Actually, her home was flooded. According to the master plan of this project, 47% of the urban area of this city will be underwater by 2008, and the population had to move. So in 2002, Chen Qiuling returned home, and saw this tragedy. Actually, the people were moving, the house were demolished, and just saw this scene. And then she moved back, because she had been in Chengdu and other big cities. All the artists went to big cities. But she moved back and produced a very moving moving video. That's her first video work. And this video is called The Songs on the Farewell, or Rhapsody on the Farewell, called Bie Fu. It is about the death. It is about the death of a place and also a death of a woman. So even from these shots, you can see it's really a lot of things. It's really the death of the place, but also a woman. And the movie, this video combined documentary film with traditional Peking opera. And this Peking opera, we all know, is called Farewell, My Concubine. Is basically about a woman committed suicide in front of river. So she combined these two stories into a very powerful presentation. This one was done in 2002. In next 5 years, Chen Qiulin continued to work on this theme, Three Gorgeous Dam, and created three more videos. I don't have time to go through them. All these four videos focus on the Three Gorgeous project. But if you see chronologically from the first one to the last one, basically from 2002 to 2007, you sense a kind of change. Chen Qiulin almost like internalized the local people's view. The first one is very dark and full of despair. It's very traumatic. But starting from the second, third, and especially the fourth one, you see the gradually transformation of landscape and the mood, the people's mood. As water had swallowed many destroyed buildings, it also concealed the wounds and scars on the land. At the same time, new modern high-rises appeared above the old towns, reorienting people's eyes with a different kind of spectacle. So actually, the last movie, you already cannot see these ruins anymore. What you see are all these high-rises. So it's a transformation of the landscape and people's mood, and also offer some hope, offer hope. So it's a very interesting example. She's from the area. She experienced this trauma, but also you cannot abandon hope. You have to live there. You have to see the future, think about the future. So that's one example. My second example is the gentleman sitting here in Feiji. Interestingly, he also made a memorable trip to the Three Gorges area in 2002, a trip that profoundly changed his art. Before this moment, most of his works were inspired by traumatic historical events in China's modern history before this trip. So the subject matter include the Opium War in 1840, the occupation of the Forbidden City by foreign troops in 1900, and especially Cultural Revolution, the trauma. So he painted those things. But after that trip, and he changed his direction, he somehow shifted his gaze and focus from the past to the present. But this traumatic experience still is the center of his art. And roaming from one ruined village to another in the area, he was there. And for several weeks, he found that, in his words, the place was experiencing a gradual decomposition even before death occurred. That's his very interesting word. It's a sense of death, but also decomposition. This experience became the basis for a large series of painting called The Empty City, 2003, and a long scroll entitled Water Rising. In both works, displacement is not only central subject of representation, but is also internalized as a style and a pictorial imagery. A particular important aspect of Yunfei's Three Gorgeous painting is their engagement with traditional Chinese art. I find very powerful, very special in contemporary Chinese art. In two ways. He engaged, I feel, engaged traditional Chinese art in two ways. The first is stylistic. The second is thematic and political. For example, if we compare these two paintings, this one is a famous, very famous, maybe the famous Song Dynasty landscape painting. We call it a monumental landscape. And the next one is one of Yun Fei's very large vertical composition painting. You compare these two. You can see there is something behind the connect. But this is wholesome, it's heroic, it's monumental. But here is almost like an anti-monument. It's everything fall into pieces. It's almost like a broken down utopian. So you can see this tradition. And now the dialogue is also how landscape, because landscape is very important in Chinese art, can embody human experience. The second way he engaged tradition is more thematic. For example, here is a 13th century painting in Art Institute of Chicago, beautiful painting. It's actually depicting the people traveling, moving away from home. You can see the water coming in, so it's really flooding. And this type of painting is called the painting of refugees, Liu Mingtu, which had a long tradition in Chinese history. You can compare Yun Fei's painting and this 13th century painting. You can see a very deep down, there is a realism, there's a sense of humanism in Chinese painting, and he also continued this tradition. Very quickly, he moved to my third painter, Liu Xiaodong. Starting from the early 90s, Liu Xiaodong has been a representative of a new kinds of a realist painting. Actually, this group of painters are called the New Realists. This type of painting departed from the socialist realist model. Instead of depicting the revolutionary masses and heroes, and this group of painters derive their materials from mundane and the fragmentary observations of human life. So these two examples were from earlier period. Again, this 2002, Liu Xiaodong made a trip. Interesting. Yun Feiji, Liu Xiaodong, Chen Qiuling, they didn't talk to each other. They all went there in the same year. But after this year, Liu Xiaodong began to create monumental, huge painting. He created three in the next 3 years. And this one is the last one called the warm bed or hot bed, wen chuang. And you can see he used an abandoned building next to the Yangtze River and worked there for the entire month in very harsh condition, very hot. And the painting is 10 meters wide. He portrayed this group of workers, laborers. They are working on the side. So in a sense is to be there and to join this project and create something very monumental, almost comparable to the project. That's the whole painting. It's very big, very, very powerful. There are some details. He actually created a kind of long brush so he could draw just like that. So it's a very fast, very beautiful painting, very powerful. Actually, it's a kind of Chinese action painting because he created there. And a lot of part is incomplete. So the incompletion also signifies something. Seems he was competing with the schedule. That's again internalized this project, competing with schedule. The last art is my last, is very interesting, very conceptual. But his name is Zhuang Hui. Action is also the central factor of Zhuang Hui's conceptual work, which took actually 12 years to accomplish. This work took 12 years to complete. The Three Gorges project officially began in December 4th, 1994. 4 months later, he was the first Chinese artist went to the site, to my knowledge. 4 months later, Zhuang Hui responded to the official undertaking with a personal site-specific project at three different locations, each corresponding to one of the Three Gorges. So he first traveled from here, there, Three Gorges, three locations. In each place, he just drilled holes, just used a long shovel, like a drill holes, like 30, like 50, then photographed all these holes and creating this very beautiful picture. And I interviewed him. He then said he was thinking when he was doing this in 1995, he was thinking 10 years later, all these holes would be 100 meters underwater. So he was leaving some traces, leaving some marks on the land. And later you cannot see it. So in 2007, he finally sent a photographer. He didn't go himself. He gave the photographer a map indicating the location of these holes and asked him to photograph the site and make a video. So then the photographer brought the video back, brought the pictures back to Beijing and showed him, and we see the water and water only. There's no holes, no landscape. So he said when he saw these pictures, he started to weep. He said, because something has changed, something has disappeared. Although we still have the Yangtze River, it's no longer the same river anymore. Thank you. Here we start.
Hello, I'm May Castleberry, editor of Library Council Publications at MoMA, and I'm here to introduce Sarah Suzuki and Yunfei Ji, who we've heard quite a bit about before. He's been well introduced, but I would like to add just a few comments. The Library Council organizes one book a year, one artist book a year, to explore the art of the book and to benefit the library and museum archives. And we stretched the definition of, or one conception of the artist book this year by making a 16-foot scroll with Yunfei Ji, so which we are celebrating tonight. Afterwards, we, as you've heard, we'd like all of you to come up to the sixth floor of the library to see the scroll. Anyway, more about Yunfei Ji. He was born in Beijing. He grew up in Hangzhou. After graduating from the Beijing Academy, he left China for a fellowship in 1986 to come to the United States. He's lived here for some 20 years, traveling back and forth to China. I believe he came to New York in 1990. He's been widely exhibited, as you've seen, at the University of Chicago and elsewhere. At the moment, in New York, you can see one of his paintings in the Rothschild Drawings Collection exhibition. You can see, actually, we're very proud to have an example of the print for our scroll at the Museum of the Chinese in America for their inaugural exhibition. And as I said, you can see that's the scroll upstairs. Sarah Suzuki is the Sue and Eugene Mercy Jr. Assistant Curator of Prints and Illustrated Books at the Museum of Modern Art. She is a highly esteemed colleague and a force for the acquisitions of Chinese art. We all really enjoy working with her. In the 8 or so years that she's been here, she's contributed to many exhibitions. And in the last 2 years, just to name a few of her achievements, she's organized Wunderkammer, a cabinet of curiosities, and the Son Dong exhibition that you may have seen earlier this year. Thank you, and see you soon.
Thanks for that lovely introduction, and thanks to everyone for being here tonight. Of course, it's really Yunfei that we have to thank for bringing us all together tonight as we celebrate his truly miraculous and beautiful new project, Three Gorges Dam Migration, and I hope everyone will have a chance to see it in person. It's pretty phenomenal when you think about it. It took well over 2 years, 500 wood blocks. I did the calculations, 1,700 feet of mulberry paper, a mile and a half of silk, a large and dedicated team of incredibly skilled printers from kind of the preeminent printing house in Beijing, and of course, one genius mind, that of the gentleman sitting next to me. You'll see upstairs, over the 10 printed feet of the scroll, he takes you on a kind of unfolding journey of this cast of characters, this kind of journey of displacement and dislocation. And when I saw it, I thought it seemed to really be kind of a crescendo of a body of work that you've been working on for a number of years. So I thought we could talk about some of the kind of precedents for that tonight. But I wondered if you'd start first by just talking a little bit about your artistic background, because I think you have an interesting story, a bit of a prodigy.
Thank you. You know, also you had to mention May. There was so it was a 2-year journey, and from the way we started, it was 2 years ago, and in between there was so much effort. She's helping. We made the four of us went to China, Milan, and Brian Shore is here today, and we were in China during the trip, and also 1,000 emails later with all this many, many details. So it's really an effort of all of us and also the people from China and the wonderful printer, carver, and you know, team of people who separate all those blocks and then had to kind of put them back together and carve every 500 blocks. So it's really an effort. And it's also a realization, that, like a dream of mine, of working with Rongbao Zhai, that I know they're able to reproduce work to really in a very high quality, that they have done Han Xi Zai Ye and Tu, they have done like all these masterpieces from the past. That I know they're, and they work very close. They worked with Qi Baishi, their previous owner, was friend with Qi Baishi and Zhang Daqian, and so I know they're just amazing. So I've always wanted to work. So when May approached me to do this project, I was really so happy that, to be able to work on this. And I actually I grew up in the late Cultural Revolution in an army hotel where it was all these disgraced army leaders who were out of job and they were just living there. And my dad is a doctor, and so he sort of take care of them. And those people include like Lu Ruiqing and Zhang Aiping. These at that time he had already jumped. He was like former defense minister of China. He couldn't stand the torture from the Red Guard. He jumped from the floor, broke his leg. And so I actually, there were a lot of also, you know, the Long March survivors who had, you know, one arm. And but they were all just at that moment in history, they were just so out of job. They were all disgraced. And people think they were dangerous even to talk to. So as a kid, I don't really know this, and come to think about, that's where I kind of grew up in this kind of environment. And later, it was a very chaotic period of, you know, there was no hardly any school, and we were all running around wild and breaking windows and things. So my parents would try to get a little interest that I have of drawing, try to keep me away from the gangs or something, so to get me to start drawing. And I had, you know, she always had a friend, artist friend, that, who are like making history paintings. And my first teacher actually was the army guy who got hired from Sichuan province to making like army menus of like hand-to-hand combat. That's why he was there. And he, you know, his family is not there, and we, these kids want some help. And so he was teaching us to draw like horses or hand-to-hand combat soldiers. And we were just like, need something to do. And so later I went to Central Academy of Fine Art, and at that time when actually it was a kind of a moment of defrosting, sort of froze, because nothing was really possible other than making propaganda work. But at that moment, there was such openness after Deng Xiaoping kind of took over. But then, before I came to the United States, again, you see a parameter was drawn, like, you cannot do these things. A lot of people at that moment was feeling really kind of depressed again, feeling that you needed to go. So there was some. So I came to the United States at that moment, so here I am.
So you started with hand-to-hand combat.
Hand-to-hand combat.
Probably. It's actually probably lucky, because that's probably more interesting for like a young man than
that's
landscape
true.
Or
that's
flowers.
Soldiers.
Or, right, something to keep you interested. Yeah. So as Professor Wu mentioned kind of earlier on, you've often dealt with history. And it was this trip in 2002 that helped you turn to the present?
Right. Because I, as a Chinese person come to live in the United States, a lot of times I feel very disoriented, you know. And somehow starting to very interested in history, because I try to understand where I come from, and including reading Jonathan's book, Search for Modern China, and try to help myself understand the experience of, including my parents' generation now, what they have went through, because the revolution and all these things are, I have very few people to talk to, and I kind of need to just to make a drawing to for myself to keep going. You know? So in a way, that was my, as a kind of exile person who is trying to kind of understand his experience, kind of try to figure out something. And that's how I started to kind of feeling a direction in my work. And,
so was the trip driven by the Three Gorges project?
It's driven by my interest in where we got to this point.
Mm-hmm.
Opium War for me is like the beginning of modern China. That, you know, we come into the modern not through our self-evolution, but through really a trauma of Opium War, where all of a sudden we all kind of throw into doubt of our these belief systems of like Confucius ideas or Buddhist ideas. All these things were, you know, main force movement out of question. And we even, so revolution really comes from all this feeling of needs to kind of build up strong arms, strong military might, and to fight, you know. And so I feel like in a way, I'm trying to understand that was through my work.
Mm-hmm.
And Three Gorges Dam is the continuation. Like as cultural revolution is creating ruins, as now with the development, they're creating ruins. And to me, like the ruins is really ruins of ideas and ideals, and some of the ideas that my previous generation held very dear and even would give up their life for, you know. But today, why we would just see ruins, you mm-hmm. know, from...
I have just these two images I wanted to show from a series that Edward Bertinsky did of photographs of the Three Gorges Dam, because I think this is probably similar to what you saw on that trip.
Yeah, right.
And I think it really beautifully illustrates exactly what you were saying, because that kind of the idea of ideals and ideas in ruins really has a physical embodiment. Mm-hmm. I mean, the landscape mm-hmm. is absolutely a ruined landscape, and mm-hmm. I would imagine that was pretty dramatic. Mm-hmm. To see.
Mm.
So if we talk specifically about this project,
mm.
I know you said that you were interested in working with Rong Baotai, you thought about that,
yeah.
and, you know, just kind of having that as an idea.
Mm.
But in terms of approaching this project and
mm.
the subject matter,
mm-hmm.
I know we've talked about a couple of different strategies
right.
that you've employed in yeah. kind of dealing with this issue in this way.
Yeah.
And Mylan very aptly, or maybe a little too generously, described tonight's event as a bit of an elegant gathering, and mm-hmm. I know that's something, an idea you've dealt with in your work also.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to just pull this example, which is from our illustrious friends up north at the Met, just to give an example for people in the audience of what a traditional elegant gathering painting might look like. And it is very much this kind of meeting of the literati to discuss painting and poetry mm-hmm. and all that. Mm-hmm. But I know you have a very different take. And that's this right. example is one that's actually in MoMA's collection of the Elegant Gathering. And maybe you could talk about this kind of satirical impulse.
I'm familiar with this. You know, at this moment, I was did a lot of travel already, did a lot of reading and sketches, and I couldn't find the entry point. And there was some moment I was reading all this newspaper stories of these arresting of these corrupt officials, mayors, or even like a police chief, that they were just like taking money from, you know, so all these like strange things they did. And I all of a sudden think about maybe I have a way to do an elegant gathering again as a kind of a gathering of the sort of a party important people and engage in some kind of strange like sexual or perverse a party of a kind, and they're you know, they're pleasuring each other and doing things, degrading each other, and, you know, backstabbing and all this you know, activities and different characters and or next slides is you know, or riding around on you know, a young servant girl's back, you know. So that was the beginning of trying to really somehow this kind of a physical like a kind of abuse or physical kind of thing somehow kind of helped me to kind of get to this sort of other issues that I was interested in.
And I know you've also talked about this idea of perversity,
yeah,
which I think is a very interesting kind of multi-layered, and it appears in another way, which is with the kind of ghost images. And maybe you should talk first, because I think culturally the ghost in China has a very different kind of meaning than it does for us in the United States.
Yeah, ghost. I grew up with ghost stories because my grandmother was telling me a lot of ghost stories. Later, it became an interest of mine, and you know, even sometimes they're more human than human, and sometimes they're standing in for all these bad things we do, and you know, so I'm very fond of ghosts. And also, I discovered through this travel that Fengdu is in between Chongqing and the dam, and that air, Fengdu is very significant because even this is the perverse thing about it, is when even when you are dead, the Chinese people are supposed to go report themselves to the underworld in Fengdu to sign in and then to be judged. So, and then I thought, that's going to be flood, that's going to be a lot of ghosts flooding in this river of a lot of, you know, old ghosts, new ghosts. And I had some newer ghosts from the Cultural Revolution who were believed in something, and they still believed in. And I thought how sad they were. They might be to see, you know, this new situation. So, you know, so the people who are still dutifully doing their duty, try to direct traffic or direct events. I feel sympathy to these characters, actually. So, they're good ghosts. Tragic, maybe, but.
And these also.
These are
bad?
I do a lot of sketches. As I do, I have a lot of drawings and a lot of photographs and things, and I have stories, and I kind of beginning in my sketchbook drawings like this. I have hundreds of these, and I line my studio wall up with all these images. And like a storyboard helped me to organize things, because I get little ideas here, little ideas there, and this, a lot of time it doesn't work together. So mm-hmm. I'm trying to kind of again try to put them together, mm-hmm. you know.
So you don't necessarily think of them then as like a master narrative when you start to work on a piece. You kind of have these vignettes, and then you'll put them together and shuffle them and rearrange them.
Exactly. I would start with something I care about, a detail, and then it would be a kind of improvisational process of to see how it leads me, and it keep me interested and also keep the thing going, and I don't really know where it's going mm-hmm. most of the time, and then I do editing later, and when I start a work, I have a lot of enthusiasm, you know, this is the one thing that's never dying, is like you have all this enthusiasm when you start a project, and then you get a lot of energy, and then you go, and then it's sort of you hit a wall, and you couldn't go anymore, and something didn't seem to go right, and then I stop and I put them aside, and I just live with them, and then maybe 2 years later I take them out, and all of a sudden I realize I could do something again, so I keep working on like that.
So, going back to what you just said, the idea about vignettes that kind of stay with you, that start to, and there's something in them that really you kind of are attached to.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe we could look at a couple of details from Empty City.
Okay.
And you could tell us a little more specifically. So this is a piece in which you're really thinking specifically about the Three Gorges project.
Yeah, yeah. This one is, you know, in this vast ruins of these abandoned cities, they're dotted little tents. Of like cheap plastic things of red, blue, and living amongst are these scavengers, people who are trying to scavenge of the metal doors and things, try to sell them. And so in this narrative I had, can we go back to the
sure.
previous? This character, this is the wife of a scavenger, and she comes to this opening in this landscape, and she's try to, in her head, imagine to tell all the deceased people that she feel close to move out of the way before the flood come. That was my, and it's getting faded away as the picture develops, according to closer people who are close to her and maybe. So that's the foundation where I started to kind of develop this image and develop sketches, develop.
From the scavenger's wife.
From the scavenger's wife, yeah. So you're kind of seeing her, yeah, you're inside her, what she's seeing or what she's hallucinating.
And in this one, so this is one of the tents that you were talking about, red and blue striped tents.
Yeah. And then, you know, you have these people are traveling with their things, but this case are the dead are trying to move as well. And so everywhere I go during my travel, it's like, it's the 143 meter watermark is really posted everywhere in the landscape. It's really, so that's the title, where the title comes from. And there's sort of a general idea of the representation is you read as a landscape as well as some of the high mountains it's agreed upon, that they represent that the big mountain represent the emperor or the supporting mountain that represent his court, you know, the people who bow down to him. So in a way, I'm trying to kind of using this to kind of again represent the state power and then the ruin below and then the people living amongst the ruin. And here the ruin really is, I wanted to go at this idea of the ruin of the ideals and the ruin of, you know, especially the previous generation. Mm-hmm.
And so how does that piece compare to this one, which was made in the same year?
Same year, and here, you know, the previous work is like more about the hierarchy of the state, where this one is more kind of a, without a center, they were like evenly distributed, more like democratic or more without a one center, they're just everywhere, et cetera.
So in looking at these works that are kind of leading up to the scroll, it gave you, I'm sure, a chance to kind of think about how you wanted to approach this project. Because what strikes me about this is really how narrative it seems to be. Mm. You kind of start with this group of characters. Mm. There they are. And you seem to kind of follow them through as you kind of unfold, as this kind of progression reveals itself before you. So you had decided that you wanted to kind of work with this group of characters?
Yeah, this is a really opportunity with this, making this mounting of the scroll and the calligraphy, because the scroll really is usually opened by two people and you look at one section at a time. So as you open up the scroll, you see four characters. They're water rising in Badung and they're very bleeding. It's a lot of water in the ink and so they're bleeding. And then you start seeing this section, and I wanted to somehow to get the viewer engaged with the people, their clothing, all the details of their belonging, to develop feelings for these people is what I wanted to slowly get engaged. And I have this idea of when I was a kid in the countryside, my grandmother lived in the countryside, and there was a way of storytelling of where it was like one drum. A very simple kind of storytelling, and I wanted to do a painting like that, of a very simple. Sometimes it's telling a story. Sometimes you hear this music, and somehow just making a sound, you know, to go with the storyteller. Somehow that form really moves me, and I wanted to do a visual equivalent of that kind of music, of a very kind of quiet evening, and you would sit there and with your fan, and you were hot. And then there was someone who was trying to tell you a story with a little drum, and they go, and you know, they go, and then they go, boom, and the little drum, and then they could tell this little longer story. You can go hours, you know, but I feel like, in a way, I'm trying to do the same thing here. It's trying to get you kind of involved, here these few bright colors of clothing that I was very interested in. These women are wearing these like bright color clothes, and that's really I wanted to for you to see. And this mother and this daughter, and they were, you know, they have back turned towards you, and you know they might be talking or she's looking at this side. I wanted to that kind of form kind of a music, you know.
So they give a kind of rhythm.
A rhythm, an openness and closeness, wetness, the ink wet, and then the dry ink mark, you know, the busy, the open. Like, in a way, I wanted to sort of develop like a music, you know.
And there's the boar that Professor Spence had mentioned. Can you talk a little bit about the boar?
Yeah, I wanted to something surprising to come from this, because the whole approach is very much about everyday. And also, it's true. It's really I wanted to some representation of really evil in amongst all this, like just very quiet moment. You know, they're waiting. Everyone is just waiting to be. They're coming from the life where they know for generations that they, and they're on their way to another place unknown. In fact, I do know now. I just visited the resettlement village recently, and all these people, they've settled like in all over China, like thousands of miles away. Sometimes in these urban slums, and they. All these industrial areas where they are made into workers, or the hopefully that the government hope that they will be finding jobs in these, like say Guangzhou or in Shenzhen, that they can work, you know, making money and things, have a new life. But a lot of time it doesn't work because you know they are not used to this work life of this, because they were farmers and they're. You know, so it's there's a bit of a cultural shock for them.
So just a couple of other details. So you can see people with all of their bags and parcels of stuff. Mm. And again, that kind of repeating bright patterning in the fabrics, which really do, I think, help you to connect. Because those characters kind of stand out a little bit.
Yeah.
And it does allow you to kind of connect with them as you move through. Yeah. And, I mean, one of the beautiful things about it, as with many scrolls, is that as the viewer, you kind of follow...
Into the mic. We can't hear you back here.
Sure.
Thank you.
One of the interesting things about it as a viewer is that you experience the journey the way they do. It has a temporal dimension. Mm. So as you kind of unroll the next chapter, in a way, you're experiencing it along with characters.
Yeah. And also, but also this, it's a calligraphy is so important in my study of, or in all the artists' study in China, calligraphy, the making of line. It's like same in writing as in painting, but the line is the basic component of this image, and the line itself is the image, you know, is so the organization of the line.
And this last detail is one that Professor Spence also referred to, which is that of the kind of pontoon boat of the officers arriving. And I know that this kind of moved around in the organization of the scroll, going back to that idea of storyboarding and figuring out kind of the order of things. Can you talk a little bit about how and why?
Yeah, I had a two version of this. The four of us went to China and with one scroll in hand and hoping maybe if we were all very lucky we can produce this much of the scroll. and they were saying how long it's going to take, how impossible it's going to be. And so I was, okay, maybe I'll make a new version, a simplified version. So I came back and remade the whole scroll. Another month and a half went by. And so I had a new idea. I had this, you know, this opening with this... truck was a propaganda truck from the Cultural Revolution coming from the sky was like blast into the scroll, and you know, with loudspeaker. So I had a lot of this kind of this kind of noise, the energy to start the scroll, and then the ending also was, you know, So, and then I had a calligraphy breakdown in the middle and maybe two panels. So I got a little carried away. In the end, they picked this, the original. They were so nice to pick the original version I brought to them when they thought it was impossible. And other, really because the carver and the printer, they were, we would rather to have this more complicated version because we really think this is, you know, something. So I was very touched, really. We were all very touched that they were going the hard way, and, you know, so.
And, of course, one of the things that makes this project so different from other projects you've done is the fact that making a woodblock scroll is inherently a collaborative project. Yeah, yeah. It's not something that you can do alone. You need an entire team. It takes a village, I guess.
Yeah,
but you really need people who are skilled at drawing, at carving, at inking, at printing, at mounting, all these different things. And I know we have some images of the workshop, Rongbaozai, which is where you made this project, which has a very illustrious history, which you referred to. But maybe do you just want to walk us quickly through some of these images?
So this is a Mr. Liu. I work very close with him. He's the one that putting a 500 blocks, like this big jigsaw puzzle and register.
Wait, here are
like
the,
a millimeter.
It
has completely accurate
blocks.
Way to register. And each printing is like you know, more than 100 sheets. So he is really amazing. And I work very close to him. And doing, you know, he would print part of it, and then I would see it, and we would discuss. And later even I had a print almost finished, and I went in, and I did something. And they were, so I would keep changing and keep working with him, and at
still
one point,
storyboarding.
Yeah, endless detail. It's amazing.
But it's a big facility in there. He is carving one of the.
So this
blocks.
Mr. Chong, he's a master carver. He carved the wooden box and, you know, the names, but he's the best carver.
And that's another shot of him carving the block.
And
there's
so
the pile. There's your jigsaw pile of 500 wood blocks.
They made it two big containers. And it's interesting, and this is one of the older things that he did. Actually, it's the Hanxizai Yan to the Hanxizai dinner. And, you know, you see this early stage, the beginning carving and the finish, more or less finished stage without the carve away of the rest of the wood. And it's a pearl.
Pear wood.
So it's easy to
soft. And one of the things about Rongbaozai is they also have their own in-house mounting, which is also kind of conservation.
Oh, they're really amazing. Yeah, they saved a lot of important Chinese artifacts, including a very early Buddhist text from this big Buddha, the stomach, and they were already like eaten by rats and things, and they were able to remount the whole text in an amazing way.
So this is their in-house mounter, working with your mile and a half of silk to do the mounting. All right. Well, I think we probably should invite our other panelists up, and we'll ask if our audience has any questions for any of the speakers. We do have two microphones in the audience. We do have two microphones in the audience, so if you have a question, I would just ask that you wait until the mic gets to you. Any questions? If not, I will start by asking you,
there is one.
Oh, good. Okay.
Well, I'm sorry to appear so dumb about this, but is it common practice for scrolls to be produced with woodblock prints? And what impact does that have then on the conception and the execution of the art? It's completely new to me that this technique was used for the scroll.
Well, I think traditionally woodcut was not the way that they were executed, but certainly I know Yunfei is an artist who's worked with printmaking techniques before. He's made some intaglio prints. And for a project like this where you're making an edition, I think that's the way you want to go. However, Rongbaozai has a very long tradition of doing what is essentially a reproductive style of woodblock printing that I think you were telling me they showed an artist their woodcut version and his original version and asked him, to tell them which was the original, and he was hard-pressed to do it. So it's incredibly, so incredibly detailed and so nuanced that when you see it, it's very hard to distinguish from a watercolor. It's a pretty remarkable practice. Would you agree?
Yeah. That, so that artist is Qi Baishi. He's a friend with the owner of the Rongbaozhai. And one time there were two paintings put in front of Qi Baishi, and both are Qi Baishi, and Qi Baishi couldn't tell which one is the real Qi Baishi.
But so when you were approached about doing this project, did you know that woodcut was something that appealed to you?
Woodcut very much appealed to me. I have did a intaglio like etching, which I enjoy very much. It's a very different process altogether. And I did the registration. I work with Holland Weaver. They're great people. And I learned so much from them during the process. But I draw everything, and you know, and but this one is impossible because the last scroll they did really. Is this is on paper that which is their very strong suit, in it, but they were spent 20 years doing the Yanxi the Yiyan Tu on silk, which is really impossible to print, and they 20 years and they carved more than 1,000 blocks, try to reproduce it, and you know this is during in the middle of the 20 years it's a cultural revolution. And it's like a generation of great people that were just spent on the Hanxi Zaiyan. And it's really, that itself is really incredible. And so there are artists themselves, calligraphers, and these carvers and printers. Rongbaozhai has a really amazing history of also collecting. They had saved a lot of great work during the Cultural Revolution where, you know, they were, you know, Mi Yuanzhang, great calligraphy was lost because last emperor was carrying them, trying to sell them in Manchuria, and then got lost. And then some, you know, it wound up with some young kid's hand. Or so they also collect this, and also Qi Baishi, Zhang Daqian, they also show their work as a gallery. So they were able to assemble all these amazing people. Artists themselves, many times, in the woodblock printing section, and in also mounting, all the best, really the best crafts, best people, and they're backed by the government. It used to be the 300-year history, and the first 200 years were owned privately owned. Later, they have the financial backing of the government, so that's why they were able to collect in during the Cultural Revolution.
So it seems like they were kind of the obvious choice as a collaborator. But could you talk a little bit more about what was it about working in woodcut for this project that made sense or appealed to you?
Oh, that's yes. Woodcut is, you know, I'm really a big very enthusiastic about the New Year's printing, you know, the door gods and things like that. I actually collect a little bit of that, and you know, when I travel. Somehow I wanted to also push my work towards a direction of more of the New Year woodcut. You know, I wanted to not ask them to reproduce what I have done with my brush, but I wanted to really push, so make it a little bit more like a woodcut, like more like this kind of, you know, this more crude and more. Mm-hmm. I wanted to push that direction, so that's why I wanted to have this collaboration taking place, to kind of really work with them. And yes.
I have a question about your empty city. You pointed out the young woman in red with the two thermos bottles coming into the scroll from the left side, which is directly the opposite way one would normally unroll a hand scroll.
That's true.
So. What was your thinking about structuring the scroll to come from left to right instead of the traditional way?
It's
maybe as a further add-on to that, are there reasons, because of your life here in the United States, that would that have had some relationship to that, or were you thinking purely in terms of countermanding a kind of traditional way of looking?
Thanks for the question. I at that point, I was mostly showing my work behind framed on the wall, and so I had a, it's something I think about. Should I do this way or this way? It's always something that bugged me. Really, I wanted to do this way as a scroll. This time, it's open as scroll. It's easy. The choice is you open the scroll from this side, and I went up the other side. But as the installation in the gallery, many times the habit here is to read from left to right. So many of my scrolls are from left to right. And I had a last show I did at James Cohen Gallery. I had a scroll. Our one side is reading from left to right, and the other side is from right to left. And they disappear. It's where the two drawings in the middle. And so I have a various different approach. Try to resolve this because so it's a very good question. Thank you.
Living here and the experience of contemporary art, Western art, has influenced you in any way?
I live in Brooklyn, and there are so many. I live among other artists, so all people I respect, and also artists from the past, I like amazing. I mean, I don't know where to start. Like Philip Guston, like I've been influenced by many different artists of the past, Western artists. Very much so. I would say in general is yes. Yeah.
Actually, I think he started as an oil painter. And he entered the fine arts, the Central Academy, the best school, age of 15.
Yeah,
so he skipped the entire high school for just immediately. So that year was possible. Is it 80 or 70? 78. When Chinese school just reopened this PhD master program. So he was selected as a teenager, 15, become like in oil painting department.
In the oil painting department.
Was a very interesting transformation from an oil painter, basically in Western style, to using this medium.
Yeah, it's a very...
And that occurred in China, right? Not here.
A long time of trying to find my voice and trying to find my direction. So I had a trip to Dunhuang, and I copied a lot of Dunhuang murals and the Jia Yuguan. I was very, because we were doing all these long-term projects in the studio, drawing models, painting models, and where when I travel to see those old things, they're so alive. Like the things about, I grew up with these history painters who make glorious battles, victory over Japan, or defeat the nationalists, the history paintings, where... They follow a certain code of representation where the Chairman Mao is always the most important, like in religious painting in the West, Jesus Christ. And then the supporting character and, the people close to him usually is the workers because they are the most revolutionary. And then the farmers are slightly less. Or, there is always this code of representation, but that sort of deadens art, I feel. As a young person, I was very much in rebellion against all this code of correct representation. So when I see these ancient work, all of a sudden they're like breath of fresh air for me. I was astonished at how much alive they are, really, how much life is in them, and that they can inspire me, give me energy, So... So at that time, I was on the third year in the academy already. I was kind of abandoning this whole painting, way of painting, to a more of another way. And I always want to find what's another way to be more connected, to...
Okay, I have a question about the subject itself, for all of the panelists. We heard earlier that it's creating a huge amount of electricity for the country, but on the other hand, we see that it's displacing vast numbers of people and submerging important places with history. I'm wondering, do you think of the scroll as a kind of documentary, as a realism, as expressing just the fullness of this phenomenon, or do you think of it more in terms of being a kind of commentary, a personal perspective on this event?
Because I've done quite a large group of work now related to the, so I've tried all different approach, like I, from very documentary, trying to be very documentary too, because I feel sometimes commentary are best made just by honestly reporting, or as I know how to report in a very matter-of-fact way. Sometimes I, like you see earlier, I'm trying to be, try to come up with something very crazy also to respond, because I feel this, it's impossible to respond, really. I feel like every way I come up to the response, I never was very happy with it or very satisfied. I was trying to come up with better response. So I'm trying different ways and in a way, so. Maybe because it's so impossible, really.
The question is a very interesting, difficult one. But certainly from what little I know about the 17th century scrolls, when they were doing the emperor's tours, and we have a great expert on this field right here. But it's been found fairly recently, I think, in the last few years by research scholars that people making scrolls of great rivers, for instance, in the middle of the 17th century or late 17th century, they would do sort of in a sense both things. They would be documentaries and they would also be commentaries. And they would the painters would study the sort of the mode of incorporating all kinds of different Chinese landscapes into one scroll to speak to the grandeur of the country as a whole. I'm thinking of a scholar called Jiang Jinsong, I think, who is now in teaching in Korea. But there, scholars working on this famous painter's work have found a sort of act of a long period of preparation, of gestation, to make China as glorious as possible through the rivers. And in doing that, you inevitably are doing a kind of encyclopedic montage of lots and lots of different landscape paintings, right? And so the scroll itself can be historical, it can be, in this case, also career-oriented, because if you get known as a great painter of evocative scrolls, it can be a very lucrative life for you. And in this particular case in the 17th century, it led to the emperor actually appointing a painter called Wang Hui to be the official recorder of the Great Southern Tour. And that finished scroll, when you know, the size is daunting. We hear about the sizes, but that the finished scroll, as far as I remember, was about 300 meters long, 300 yards long or more. We're dealing with big projects here, and that would have taken that did take enormous teams. Some of these, but as a driving force, there is sort of historical memory. And an encyclopedic coverage of previous figures in China's past. And so the landscape is distilled. You can't really use it as a historian might use a geographical map, because the artist is manipulating it and changing it, but making the kind of echoes that any intelligent Chinese critic would get right away. Indeed, just a regular gentry member would understand that. And the audience will also have poems on those sites maybe already in their heads and so on. So this is a very active and lengthy tradition and a very exciting one, I think. I'm only a tiny dabbler in this, but real connoisseurs get so much out of that, the juxtaposition.
I want to return actually to the first question. Actually, I've been thinking about that question. I think it's very important. Just a why woodblock? Why not just painting? Then I think Yunfei has been saying, actually, from early on, he has developed this profound interest in this, we may say, folk art or mass media or mass production. It's not just a reproduction. It's a kind of art form, right? So like a New Year painting you're talking about, So I see this work is not a reproduction of something else. It's, to you, it's really is you collaborating with this Rong Baojai studio to create particular form. It's a new art form. I think just we have been talking a lot about different mediums and art forms. You told me a lot about this woodblock. Mm. It's not just a matter of reproduction. You have a painting, you reproduce like a photograph. Mm. Actually, you want to explore this art form. That's my feeling.
Yeah.
You have this excitement about the form itself. Just try to answer. There's a question. Why have to be a woodblock, right?
Thank you. Yeah, that's exactly.
We probably have time for one more question. There's someone at the back there. Is there a hand?
Is there, as a U.S. resident artist, was there any effect of potential censorship or limitation in political content arising in the course of your production? Could you have done something different if you had to, if you didn't have to do it in China?
We were a little bit worried as we taking our trip there with this scroll, but they is at the beginning we approached two shops, Rong Baojai and Dong Yinxuan in Shanghai, and Dong Yinxuan seemed at the beginning they were hesitating, we don't know why, and then Rong Baojai seemed to really go with very more strongly. That's also part of the reason we went with Rong Baojai. And Rong Baojai has a powerful backing. the people in charge in there are connected with, you know, people in high places. So if they're okay, then if they're not too fearful. So and I today's climate in China are much, first of all, this new generation, the Three Gorges Dam was really backed by Li Peng, the previous prime minister, who were himself an engineer who really interested wanted to leave his name and history in building these big projects, where the new generation of leaders are more concerned with the environment, environmental damage, and they're a little more sensitive to, they see the more, they're not the great, the difficulty. And so I think in already, they're not so positive, just you have to say great things about the Three Gorges Dam. So that's the climate we're in as we approach the situation. So I think it was okay.
Okay. Oh.
I have one quick question.
Okay.
Did you get a sense that, like, we have such, we feel great sympathy for these people who've been displaced. Were the people that you were working with in the workshop, did they understand that?
Mentality? Yeah, no, they were so, yeah, we had many discussions about it. They were so, they were supportive. I mean, that's why they were supportive. They were supportive of the project. But, you know, this story, in a way, also is, for people in China, is not so uncommon as well, because everybody is displaced. You know, they almost like, yeah, tell me displaced story again, because, you know, I displaced myself, you know. We had to move. Like, tell me something different story. There's a little bit of, because almost everyone was had to move, you know, of everywhere, like in Beijing, in Shanghai, in the countryside, you know. So, I mean, just imagine you were brought up with one set of values, and then you kind of living in a completely different world. In itself, is very displacing anyway. And plus all the physical change, you know. China is building these cities. They say one Boston a day, and they, you know, the great process of urbanization, industrialization, of needing all these people from the countryside to come to work for Walmart, you know. So, and the party leadership is trying to mass produce all this mindset of, you know, obedient worker. You know. So that's the situation.
Okay, so thanks to the panelists so much.
And thanks to all of you for joining us, and I hope you'll join us on the sixth floor to take a look at the Scroll in the Flesh.